the bottom of this story. You can listen to the Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio. The Spotlight.
Welcome to Spotlight. Lebanon's resistance movement, Hezbollah, has fired dozens of rockets at Israel in response to the regime's airstrikes. The Lebanese president has denounced the Israeli raids as a direct threat to the security and stability of the region, and the country's parliament speaker has said Israel only understands the language of unity and resistance. In this edition of the Spotlight, we'll look at the reasons behind the recent Israeli escalation and the significance of Hezbollah's response to the aggression.
Lebanon's resistance movement Hezbollah says it has fired dozens of rockets near positions of Israeli occupation forces in the Shabah farms. Hezbollah added that the latest round of rocket fire came in response to the Israeli air raids that hit South Lebanon on Thursday. In an interview with a local agency, Hezbollah's Deputy Secretary General Sheikh Naim Qasim stressed that the resistance is much more capable than it was in 2006, yet downplayed the possibility of an all-out war.
In this phase, the resistance is in an extremely high state of readiness, and it cannot even be compared to the level of capability and alertness which was present in 2006. Whether in the arms, preciseness, military planning, training, preparation, and capabilities. And Israel knows this. So if they launch a foolish aggression under any pretext, Hezbollah will be ready.
An Israeli military spokesman stressed that Israel does not wish to escalate to a full war, but is prepared for it. Experts believe Israel was trying to move escalation towards the inside of Lebanon, but the resistance took things back to square one.
The Israelis have been trying for a while to change the rules of engagement with Lebanon, but Hezbollah's resistance has proven today that the Israelis cannot change the status quo as long as there is a resistance which is ready to face the Israeli aggressions. This was not only retaliation to the latest round of Israeli shelling, it was also a warning and a response to all the violations committed by the Israelis, whether in the air, land or sea.
Lebanese President Michel Aoun and Lebanese caretaker Prime Minister Hassan Diab urged the United Nations interim forces in Lebanon to put pressure on Israel to stop its aggressions against Lebanon's sovereignty. Several statements from Palestinian resistance groups were issued in support of Hezbollah's retaliation, which many see as stressing the full legitimacy of resistance groups to face occupation forces. With no civilian areas targeted from both sides, the status quo seems to have remained unchanged. It's the first time the Israelis launched such an attack against Lebanon since the 2006 war, but it's also the first time since then that the Lebanese resistance retaliates with multiple rockets against an Israeli military occupation post. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Well, joining us, we have Professor of International Relations at Lebanese University, Mr. Jamal Wakim, joining us from Beirut. Also, journalist and political commentator Saeed Mohsen Abbas is joining us from the British capital, London. Well, gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Wakim in the Lebanese capital, Beirut. Mr. Wakim, how do you view the escalation of tensions, and also what are your views on the timing of all of this?
Well, I believe that what happened was an attempt by the new Israeli Prime Minister, Bennett, to prove himself stronger than his predecessor, Netanyahu, by changing the rules of engagement with Lebanon. So that's why he capitalized on an incident of firing two rockets on occupied Palestine to wage or to escalate the situation by waging air raids for the first time since 2014. And this was the response of the Islamic resistance was to wage this attack, which put things back to square one in this regard, because the the Israelis didn't dare to react to this, and they chose to downgrade their reaction, and they didn't attack back. So that's why I believe that Bennett got embarrassed, and now he's facing mounting criticism inside Israel, especially from supporters of Netanyahu, who use this to as a mean to attack Bennett, who because Bennett himself used to criticize Netanyahu for not escalating his attacks against Lebanon in reaction to, let's say, launching rockets from Lebanese territories. So I believe that this was the reason why the new government, the new prime minister, was trying to test the ground and see if he can fare better than his predecessor facing the Islamic resistance. However, he it proved him wrong, and he had to back down on this.
Said Mohsen Abbas in London. Hezbollah said the rockets were in retaliation for the Israeli attacks. A while back, if you recall, Secretary General of Hezbollah, Sayed Hassan Nasrallah, he said that they now had twice as many precision-guided missiles as they did a year ago. Has the capacity of resistance forces to respond changed the equation for the Israeli regime now?
It's changed it for a considerable amount of time. I mean, since 2006, Hezbollah has increased its capacity, both in terms of quality of military on the ground capability, but also with weaponry. They were particularly skilled in the 2006 war at using anti-tank weapons. Their light infantry was known to be, in many ways, superior to Israel on their own ground. The tactics that they used were extraordinarily effective in pushing back the Israeli invasion. In fact, Naftali Bennett was one of the soldiers who actually was a commanding officer within that invasion, and was also the victim of a defeat, and a bitter defeat. So some of this may well be also to do with him wanting to sort of readdress unfinished business, if you like. But the reality on the ground is this: that Hezbollah has the armed strength of a medium-sized army. Nobody knows the full capacity of weaponry and arsenal and power they have now. That's not something which certainly either Israel or anybody else can make a firm estimate on. Groups like the James group, they've assessed that Hezbollah has more than 25,000 full-time fighters and perhaps around 30,000 reservists. But all this is guesswork. What they do know is that Hezbollah has now also got skills in terms of maneuvers, strength of being able to maneuver in conventional warfare, given their experience in Syria and fighting ISIS and the Zio Western proxies out there. So there's no, I think, delusion on the part of the Israeli Defense Force that they're up against a very skilled, very motivated, very pious fighting force. You're not dealing with an ordinary army when you're talking about Hezbollah. These men are not just fighting for land. They have an ideological and spiritual commitment to defending the oppressed, which goes beyond your average soldier. They're certainly not in it for the money or being paid for by the American or the Israelis. And they're certainly not children or kids being conscripted by force to serve in the IDF. So overall, Israel may be testing the ground. They've been given their answer. I think that they'd be wise to take note and not continue any further aggressions on the Lebanese sovereignty.
Mr. Joachim, the recent attack on the Israeli tanker off the coast of Oman, that was seen as a response to the Israeli regime's hostile activity. Are regional resistance forces conveying the message now that there will be consequences for Israel's hostile behavior?
Well, I believe that this is true, because Israel is taking an all-out, let's say, attack on the resistance movements. However, the attack on Israeli tanker in the Sea of Oman is a clear message that Israeli aggressions will not pass without reaction. So this is very important. And at the same time, I believe that what's happening cannot be, in Lebanon, for example, is not detached from what's going on in the Sea of Oman or elsewhere in the Middle East.
Sure. Said Mohsen Abbas, the Arab League, in a statement, noted that the practices of the new Israeli administration headed by Prime Minister Naftali Bennett are meant to display its force. That's something that Mr. Wakim also alluded to. Do you think that that could have been the initial move for the new Israeli Prime Minister? And given the response now, are the Israelis in a dichotomy as to whether they should escalate their attacks or not?
It certainly will be a part of the play, but don't forget the Islamic Republic of Iran has had just had a change of guard. The new president, Ayatollah Raisi, is now firmly in office. So generally, the Israelis are in a high state of nervousness. They understand that what's happening in Islamic Republic of Iran and what's happening even in Lebanon and in Yemen and in Syria is all, and of course Iraq as well, not to forget Iraq, is all ultimately focused with them in mind. The fact of the matter is the rising power, the rising strength, the rising unity of the Arab world, and including, of course, Iran as well in West Asia, is, of course, hugely worrying. Never before have the Israelis, not since certainly before Yom Kippur, the war back in the 70s, have they actually faced an adversary that was really, truly capable of challenging them. And they know this. Now, they're in a real quandary. If you don't go for the resistance axis, the Islamic Republic of Iran, Lebanon, of course, Hezbollah, if you don't take an action against them now as an Israeli military or even as a sort of a broader NATO, American, etc., alliance as well, then they're going to be calculating, the strategists in Israel will be calculating that this force will only grow. It'll only become more powerful. So what do you do? Do you tackle the resistance axis now and try to finish it off or push it back? Or do you just wait and hope that there isn't the strength within the resistance axis to ever actually fully take on Israel toe-to-toe in an open war? Well, this is between a rock and a hard place, really, for Israel. And they are really, I think, very, very confused as to what they ought to do. You can see they've been rattling the sabers, trying to draw in the world. That's what the language has been over this Sea of Oman issue that was raised. They've been trying to rally them to all come and attack Iran. Well, the fact is that they couldn't defeat Hezbollah and Lebanon in a 22-day war. They couldn't defeat the Palestinian resistance in a even shorter lived folly that most recently. What chance would they stand against the entire Islamic resistance axis if they were to rattle that little, nest of, hornets, if you from their point of view? I don't think that they really know what they're doing. So what they've actually been doing, and this military show is an act of bravado, but what they've been doing more cunningly, of course, don't forget, is that they've been trying to instigate civil war in Lebanon. They've the death of Ali Shibli, for instance, at a wedding, shot down by some extremist chaps, Ahmed Gonsa, I think the name of the gentleman is, who actually killed Ali Shibli, who was a member of Hezbollah, who's an active member, is one of those kind of incidents which is designed to stir tension, to create sectarian, aggravations, and also, of course, to test Hezbollah. Hezbollah's been very cool and calm, and the whole incident has been toned down. But color revolution has been added to this desire to create sectarian civil war. That's been going on the back of the economic sanctions, which again are instigated by the Anglo-Zionist axis to try and bring Lebanon to its knees. So all of these things are going on: sabotage, proxy politicians within Lebanon, the economic sanctions, color revolutions. You know, they've tried everything to try and break Lebanon because primarily Hezbollah sits on their doorstep and they don't like it. And that's their main priority, is to try and divide and destroy their key opposition in the region.
Professor Joachim, the Arab League, as we're staying on that topic, warned that escalating hostilities between Lebanon and Tel Aviv regime could spiral out of control, adding that Lebanon has been passing through a difficult time and could not endure more tensions. When will these platitudes and mere words end? When will there be tangible action from the likes of the Arab League?
Well, I don't believe that there will ever be an action by the Arab League. The Arab League was first installed in 1945 by the British as an umbrella to control the Arab states and put them all the time under British and later on under American hegemony. So that's why I don't, throughout its history, except for the period in the 1950s and 1960s when Nasser ruled Egypt, but throughout its history, the Arab League was always a mirror of the Western resolutions and an accessory of British and then U.S., policies in the region. So that's why we saw that all its resolutions were would always fall in the benefit of the U.S. policies in the region. And this was best featured in the past three decades, whether in the blockade imposed by the U.S. on Iraq, later by its inability to oppose the invasion, the American invasion of Iraq, and then the conspicuous role of the Arab League in justifying many resolutions taken against Arab countries that are not abiding by the Western will, most important Syria, and the conspicuous role of the Arab League in Syria in this regard. So we don't count on the Arab League to stand as an independent actor, and we don't count on its resolutions whenever it comes to confronting Israel by an Arab country or by the Islamic.
Said Mohsen Abbas, the Lebanese caretaker prime minister, has called on the UN to exert some pressure on the Israelis to halt its aggression on Lebanon. Are you expecting to see any response from the UN? The UN peacekeeping mission in Lebanon has also warned the situation is very dangerous. That's even more of a reason for the UN to take action now.
Well, the UN has proven itself to be a toothless tiger. It really is a defunct organization in terms of being able to prevent wars, that's for sure. They might have some arguments to say in terms of helping people who are victims of wars, etc. They may be able to go and do things like that. But really, they have no say and they have no power. You have a veto in the UN, which belongs to the Americans, and the Americans will use that veto every time to favor Israel, to prevent any progress or any justice or fairness being exercised in that region. This is just a reality. In fact, the Americans have exercised that veto dozens and dozens of times, more for Israel than any other veto. That's the American track record. So you've got a block there. The UN just won't do anything. They can go through sort of platitudes and make noises and say how dangerous things are, but really they are not the answer. In fact, no international organization really is the answer. There is only one answer, and Ayatollah Khamenei, Sayyid Nasrallah have all pointed to this. The only language they understand, the Israelis and the Anglo-Zionist axis, is military and hard power. And I think that's the direction that Hezbollah went after seeing Israel's constant efforts to invade Lebanon, and they build up tactical strengths. They have, you know, fantastic skills in cover and concealment in their own territories, you know, in that terrain of South Lebanon, etc. They are great with direct fire, preparation of their fighting positions. You know, they've got lots of fabulous, you know, fighters who are very capable of taking out tanks, and the Israelis much wanted tank squadrons,
right,
were heavy blows. So I don't see Israel making this calculation, even though they've got aerial power, aerial support. I don't think they can contemplate a head-on war with Hezbollah. 150,000 missiles, by their own admission, are sitting, waiting for any move that Israel makes. Now, you don't know what the scale of those ballistic missiles or those weapons are, because having been linked to Iran, goodness knows whether they've got the Bavar, whether they've got all the other, you know, wonderful array of arsenal which Iran has been very publicly showing and actually demonstrated to America, too, indeed, as to what it was capable of.
All right, one last question for Mr. Wakim. We've got probably less than a minute. Lebanon's Parliament Speaker, Nabi Berri, he said that the Israelis only understand the language of unity and resistance. How important are these two elements, unity and resistance, when it comes to opposing the Israeli regime?
Well, I believe that this is very important. They have proved very important in the past four decades. Of course, power and strength, most important. Unity in Lebanon, too bad, we were never able to achieve unity, and the Islamic resistance had to pass through a lot of difficulties in the past four decades because of the lack of unity. But despite of this, it was able to achieve major victories over the Israelis, and that's why we believe that we will achieve victory in any confrontation that will occur in the future.
All right, thanks a lot. That's all the time we have for tonight's show. Allow me to thank my guest, Jamal Wakim, Professor of International Relations at Lebanese University, joining us from Beirut. And also thanks to Saeed Mohsenabbas, journalist and political commentator, joining us from the British capital, London. Also, a special thanks to you, our viewers, for staying with us on Spotlight. It's good night for now.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu Alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran, by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Hello everyone, dear brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and we're with you with another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. In this edition of the program, we'll be discussing the commentary of the 23rd chapter of the Holy Quran, Surah Al-Mu'minun, or the Believers. Now let's just listen to the related verses, and then we'll be back. So stay with us.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
بَلْ قُلُوبُهُمْ فِي غَمْرَةٍ مِّنْ هَذَا وَلَهُمْ أَعْمَالٌ مِّنْ دُونِ ذَلِكَ هُمْ لَهَا عَامِلُونَ.
But Their hearts are covered with confusion over this, and they have evil deeds besides disbelief which they are doing. Until when we seize their affluent ones with punishment, at once they are crying to Allah for help.
Dear listeners, as you have been with us in the previous programs, we were talking about the characteristics of the believers in this chapter. But then the verse changed from the topic of the believers to the fact that these unbelievers have forgotten all about the day of resurrection and they are captivated by their misconducts. But their hearts are in overwhelming ignorance of this. The 63rd verse said, بَلْ قُلُوبُهُمْ فِي غَمْرَةٍ مِّنْ هَذَا وَلَهُمْ أَعْمَالٌ مِّنْ دُونِ ذَٰلِكَ هُمْ لَهَا عَامِلُونَ. And they have besides that other deeds which they are doing. Now in the 64th verse, the Almighty Allah says, حَتَّى إِذَا أَخَذْنَا مُتْرَفِيهِمْ بِالْعَذَابِ إِذَا هُمْ يَجْأَرُونَ. Until we seize the luxurious ones of them with punishments, behold, they groan. The Quranic word yaj'arun means the howl of a dog or wolf when the animal is hurt. This likening of the groans of the tranquil, negligent ones to the howls of the dog could be a sign of their abjectness, they are completely intoxicated by this world, and no other means except the divine punishment can awaken this conceited, proud, and tranquil group, and they are completely drowning in the pleasures of the world. As I said, they're completely intoxicated. Till such a time, they will remain ignorant, they will remain negligent, conceited by this world and their wealth, their power and comforts. But when they're punished, at that time, they will howl like beasts, and they groan because of the heaviness of the divine chastisement. The verse says, حَتَّى إِذَا أَخَذْنَا مُتْرَفِيهِمْ بِالْعَذَابِ. Until we seize the luxurious ones of them with punishment, إِذَا هُمْ يَجْأَرُونَ. Behold, that they groan. So this is the eventuality, and this is the end of being intoxicated, being self-conceited and proud by the pleasures of this world. At the end, there will be howling like dogs and wolves.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
In this
word.
Series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic approach.
We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
وتمثل القرآن في أخلاقه وفعاله فيه الفؤاد تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insight into the Holy Quran.
by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom.
And one of the reasons that they are intoxicated by this role is the kind of approach they had towards their wealth in this world. They did not use this as means of giving people charity, doing good deeds and righteous acts. They just kept swallowing them themselves. They did not give anything of it to the other people. But because they are so self-conceited, they are so intoxicated, no other means except this punishment, this divine punishment, can awaken them. They are completely drowning, and they have immersed themselves in the pleasures of this world. So how can they be awakened? Dear listeners, it could be one of the reasons that this verse says, إِذَا هُمْ يَجْأَرُونَ, behold that they groan, like howling of the dogs and wolves. It could be because of the fact that the luxurious life, the wealth and pleasures of this world have become parts of their bodies, have become parts of their lives. So in that case, if you want to cut off somebody's organ from him, if you want to take away someone's organs, some parts of his bodies from him, this is really excruciating pain. That's when they start howling. That's when they start groaning, because you are taking away something from them that they consider a part of their bodies. Not only that, but they consider themselves parts of that thing. This is the reason they have become existent in this world. This is what they think. But then when they see the facts, when they see the scene of resurrection, they start saying, alas. That's why the verse says, behold, they groan. إِذَا هُمْ يَجْأَرُونَ. Thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us in this program. We ask the Almighty Allah to set us among the guided ones and the people of the straight path. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. Your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at EnglishRadio@IRIB.ir. Also, visit our website at parstoday.com. Until the next program, take care.
Things always worked for me. Why ends when fate begins?
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Round the world with reporters.
Pakistan's president, foreign minister, and others joined this rally in support of the people of Kashmir. The rallies were held in Pakistan to mark the second anniversary of India's, what Pakistan says, illegal move to revoke the special status of the disputed Kashmir region. India on August 5, 2019, abrogated the Article 370 of the Indian Constitution that granted special status to the Jammu and Kashmir region. Pakistan rejected the move as a violation of the UN Security Council resolutions that seek a referendum to decide the final status of Jammu and Kashmir.
I want to assure my Kashmiri brothers that Pakistan will continue to support the people of Kashmir for their right to self-determination. We will continue to support Kashmiris till they get freedom.
Go India, go back!
Separately, Kashmiri leaders also took to the streets in Islamabad. The All Parties Hurriyat Conference staged a protest not far from the Indian High Commission in Islamabad.
We, the Kashmiris, not only in occupied Kashmir, Azad Kashmir, or in Pakistan, but over the world, where the Kashmiris are present, they are making this day as a black day. Why we are making this day as a black day? Because against the will and wish of the people of the Kashmir, India has abrogated its articles.
Protesters condemned the Indian policy towards Kashmir and vowed to continue their struggle until Kashmiris get their right to self-determination.
Kashmir is a disputed territory as per the United Nations resolutions. The resolutions have been passed and at the behest of the India. It was India who took the Kashmir disputed to the United Nations. And it is India, it is the then Prime Minister of India, Jawaharlal Nehru, who in his communique to Pakistan said, we do not believe in forced marriages, and Kashmir is will be given right to self-determination.
Kashmir remains at the heart of tensions between India and Pakistan. The dispute dates back to the partition of the subcontinent in 1947. Both countries have fought wars over the only Muslim majority state controlled by India.
Tensions between India and Pakistan have further deepened since India revoked the special status of Kashmir. Pakistan insists India has to reverse the changes for any talks. India, however, is defending the changes, calling it as its internal matter, and hence the deadlock. Kamran Yusuf, Islamabad.
The brutal battle between Taliban and government forces has intensified recently, with each side struggling to gain more area under their control. Top military officials in southern Helmand province have urged the residents of the city of Lashkargah to evacuate their houses. Reports say Afghan forces are planning to launch a heavy attack on Taliban inside the city of Lashkargah, who use residences of locals as human shields.
We had announced that if a single Talib arrives in Lashkargah city, he will be killed. Even if 1,000 of them arrive, we will kill them all. This fight is not ours. They are takfiris and slaves of Punjabis. They aren't Afghans. Our fight against them is a pure jihad, and we will continue this holy jihad with a strong will.
Taliban has in recent weeks launched more attacks on provincial capitals, mainly in southern and western Afghanistan. This comes as many have believed neither the government nor the Taliban will achieve their goals to take full control of the country via insisting on further war. They say negotiation is the only solution to resolve the conflicts.
Today, the ancient city of Herat is under attack, and the war has reached inside people's houses in Lashkargah of Helmand. Meanwhile, violence is spreading across the northern Taliban city and other areas. We still hope to reach peace through responsible moves by the government and Taliban.
Based on official figures, over 1,000 Taliban militants have lost their lives in a series of attacks carried out by Afghan air and ground forces backed by local armed fronts since last week. Afghan forces increased their attacks on Taliban militants and liberated some of lost areas, including Nijrab and Talaobarfak districts in northern and northeastern Afghanistan. Afghan President Ashraf Ghani recently called on the entire nation to establish a united national resistance front against the Taliban. He argues that since the Taliban have put military victory on the top of its priorities list, the time has come to talk to militants with guns and resistance. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
British Muslim advocacy group CAGE is preparing to go to war with the British government after announcing a legal bid against Education Minister Gavin Williamson over what they call discriminatory guidance to school leaders on Palestine. CAGE say the letter issued by Williamson on May the 28th amounted to a disgraceful censorship of political dissent in schools and discriminated against students by infringing their rights to freedom of expression.
CAGE has seen nearly 50 cases of students
who've been targeted in their schools for speaking openly about Palestine and defending the rights of the Palestinian people to defend themselves against a system of apartheid and oppression and occupation.
The government's crackdown on Palestine solidarity in UK schools occurred during the huge global outrage over Israel's relentless attacks against worshippers at the Al-Aqsa Mosque and civilians in Gaza last May. Williamson's letter warned teachers to remain impartial on the conflict, but also warned of concerning rise in anti-Semitic incidents. However, Cage believed this is censorship cloaked by bogus accusations of anti-Semitism.
It is definitely becoming more of the case that speaking on the issue of Palestine, advocating for the rights of the Palestinian people, exposing the crimes of the Israeli apartheid regime, these are becoming increasingly issues which are criminalized, issues which are securitized, dealt with very punitive measures, whether in schools, whether in the public space, public spaces, or the debate about it is completely hounded out of the public space, such that these issues are silenced and they are unheard.
Cage are confident of success, as they believe that the government's position on this topic won't hold water if confronted in the courts. And many people are hoping for success here, as the way things are going now, many critics claim and fear that it could become essentially illegal to support the Palestinian cause publicly in the not-too-distant future, unless court battles like this are won now. Robert Carter, London.
Thousands of Lebanese commemorated the first anniversary of the catastrophic explosion which rocked Beirut. Accountability and justice was the main demand of the families of the martyrs.
August 4 should turn into a historic day by holding criminals accountable. The criminals who brought the ammonium nitrate to the port, they killed our children. I lost my only son because of their corruption.
I lost my brother in the blast and lost my mother only 2 months later. She died because of her grief for her son. I want justice for the sake of my brother and my mother. We want justice and we want to see everyone connected with the crime being put on trial.
On August 4th, 2020, a stockpile of ammonium nitrate fertilizer, which was stored without prudence, exploded, becoming one of the largest non-nuclear blasts in modern history, leaving over 200 people killed and thousands injured. The state of mourning for those who fell on the Beirut port explosion is still well alive in the hearts and minds of the Lebanese people, yet justice for the victims still seems out of sight. Yet mourning rallies quickly turned violent after some protesters tried to break into the parliament building. Security forces fired water cannon and tear gas at stone-throwing protesters. Several people were injured. In parallel with the protests, a virtual conference was held in support of Lebanon, where Lebanese President Michel Aoun said the quest for truth and full justice is still the main claim of every Lebanese.
I have already committed before the Lebanese to serve justice and hold accountable everyone whose involvement is proven by the investigation. Today, I restate my pledge that no one is above the law, no matter how high they may rank. Let justice go all the way in probe and the trials.
Aoun stressed that the funds given to Lebanon from the International Monetary Fund must be spent in the best way to face the collapse and embark on reforms, one of which is forensic auditing. She highlighted as very significant. This event comes as Lebanese officials are yet to form a cabinet. Demonstrators' anger is not only at the injustice in the Beirut port case, but at the ineffectiveness of the political class in dealing with the crisis. Mariam Saleh, Beirut.
Ebrahim Raisi was sworn into office as Iran's new president, prospect of change and resolutions to make Iran a better place to live. 115 heads of state and political officials from 73 countries attended the inauguration ceremony held in Iran's parliament on Thursday. with Judiciary Chief Ghulam Hossein Mohseni Eji on his side, Raisi pledged to protect the Constitution and to serve the country and the Islamic establishment.
I, as President, swear to God Almighty before the Holy Quran and before the Iranian nation that I will safeguard the country's official religion and the establishment of the Islamic Republic and the country's constitution.
Ibrahim Raisi won the 13th presidential election on June 18th with a landslide, garnering 64% of the votes. His predecessor, Hassan Rouhani, left office with a pile of unresolved political and economic issues on the table, from snowballing inflation rates to the unconcluded nuclear talks with world powers. The 8th Iranian president vowed to fix all those issues, but he said he will not tie the country's economy to the nuclear deal.
Sanctions against the Iranian nation must be lifted. I will support any diplomatic process that would fulfill this goal. Meanwhile, the Islamic Republic of Iran regards its neighboring countries as its kin. So our first and foremost priority will be to upgrade our ties with our neighbors.
As has been the custom for any incoming administration, Raisi was endorsed by Iran's leader Ayatollah Khamenei on Tuesday. Now, after taking the oath of office, Raisi will have to name his cabinet members, who will then show up here in Majlis for a vote of confidence from lawmakers. Coming from the principalist camp, Ibrahim Raisi holds different, if not opposing, views compared to his pro-reformist predecessor, Hassan Rouhani. So something like clinching a deal with the U.S. as the ultimate way out for Iran's ailing economy is not expected to be on top of his agenda. As the new president says, he will find new destinations to fix the economy. Yusuf Jalali from the Iranian parliament in Tehran.
Since the armed resistance against Indian rule began in Kashmir in 1989, New Delhi imposed a ban on Muharram processions in Indian-administered Kashmir, reasoning these processions might be used by the pro-freedom outfits to instigate the anti-India sentiments. Despite being challenged in the court of law, the ban remained intact. However, in a surprising move, New Delhi's administration this year lifted the ban. But more than appreciation, this decision has received criticism. Aga Said Rahullah Mehdi, former member of Kashmir's Legislative Assembly in the past, has often contested the government's ban on Muharram processions. Mehdi says each time security agencies would give negative feedback.
While you have called off Amarnath Yatra, for which you mobilize entire security grid of the nation to enable that, and at the same time you didn't allow the Eid prayers for the last couple of years and this year including. And the best example to give is the Friday prayers at Central Jama Masjid, the central mosque of Grand Old Mosque of Srinagar. And it has been more than 100 Fridays that the prayers were not allowed or not allowed in that mosque. And while all this is happening, all of a sudden in isolation, you give a permission to a procession for which you denied the permission for 30 years. So to me, it is more questionable than it answers. And I have suspicions.
Mehdi says this decision by New Delhi has more to do with building a fake narrative and dividing the people of Kashmir on the communal lines.
I do not want the other section of the society to be suspicious about this section of the society, that they have the patronage of New Delhi, that they have the patronage of BJP government. If we suffer through it collectively, if we find ways to fight against it, to come out of it, we find the ways and go on those ways collectively. I do not want to see 10th Muharram procession after the gap of 30 years suddenly come up as a procession not for Imam Hussein, but for the narrative building of a fake normalcy for Narendra Modi.
Locals too are apprehensive of this move amid the coronavirus pandemic.
Let them not play politics on this at least. This is a religious matter. If they think that allowing this procession will portray normalcy, they are risking lives. I don't think this was the right time to lift the ban. This simply means they don't care for the people.
After facing huge criticism, the government has revised the decision and passed the ball into the local administration's court. Since the decision of whether the Muharram procession be allowed or not has to be taken by district administrations, it remains to be seen how well they stage and whether people participate or not. Shahana Bhatt, Indian Administered Kashmir.
Few hours after President Qais Saied's decisions were published in the official gazette, Tunisian security forces arrested lawmaker Yassine Ayari to serve a two-month jail term handed down to him by a military court in 2018.
Everyone who erred must be held accountable, but a civilian may not be tried in a military court. Everyone who committed a crime must be arrested regardless of the circumstances of the trial.
Judge Bashir Al-Akrami was placed under house arrest after being accused of covering up terror-related files, obstructing investigations into them, and violating the law regarding the files of political assassinations. Hours later, security forces raided homes of other lawmakers to implement rulings issued by the military judiciary, including Muhammad Al-Afis, Saifuddin Makhlouf, Abdul Latif Al-Alwi, and Maher Zaid, who was arrested and then released.
May God bless the president. We thank Qais Saied. We thank him for the decisions. Poverty and unemployment have overwhelmed us. I'm a Tunisian woman begging for money to buy medicine, and even my husband's salary has been seized.
About lifting the immunity of the deputies, I neither agree to nor oppose the decision. I support the enforcement of law.
On August 2nd, Tunisian security forces arrested Member of Parliament Faisal Tibini under summons issued by the first instance court in the state of Jandouba. Tibini was charged with spreading false news and offending others through social media. He also faces three other similar charges. Raids and arrested lawmakers to implement rulings issued by the military judiciary have opened the door to accusations against Saied, while leading political parties in Tunisia accuse the president of orchestrating a coup. Rights activists are concerned that the measures could open the door to further violations of citizens' freedoms.
Raids, arrests, and placing a deputy in prison to implement a ruling issued by the military judiciary opened the door to accusations against Saied, leading political parties in Tunisia accuse him of a coup. Amir Bouka, Tunis.
Following the latest Israeli escalation over the Gaza Strip that left more than 200 people dead, including women and children, Palestinians in the Gaza Strip are still recovering the psychological consequences of the war. Almost 600,000 students have suffered a significant learning loss. In conjunction with the announcement of the Palestinian high school Tawjihi scores, 18 students from Gaza are not around to receive their scores as they were killed by the Israeli airstrikes. Khalid Al-Qanoua, a Palestinian student who was supposed to be receiving his high school scores this year, was killed by the Israeli airstrikes, leaving his family grieving.
I remembered Khalid today when I saw other students. Khalid was supposed to be with us today, celebrating his success and distributing sweets like other people. I saw Khalid's mates when they were having their exams, and I felt happy that Palestinians still insist on living their life even after wars and losses. I wish Khalid was here, but I believe that by knowledge, Palestinians will take revenge for Khalid, and his death won't go in vain.
The release of the test scores is usually met with parties, fireworks, and gifts, but due to the crisis in Gaza, many Palestinian students are not celebrating their success.
I have three of my sons who finished high school, and we celebrated with them. There were always atmospheres of happiness when my son succeeded. I wish Khalid was here so we could celebrate with him. He would have been something important. This time, the Israeli occupation stole my happiness. I feel his loss in all ceremonies. Whatever the Israeli regime does with its crimes and killings, we will remain patient, and we won't give up this land.
Subhi Abu Lauf, who has lost most of his family members in the Israeli airstrikes, is also among the students who were deprived from pursuing high school, as he is traumatized by his loss.
Those are really hard times for me while students are happy for their success being around their families. I've lost my mom, my sister, and my home, and I couldn't continue going to school. There is no place for happiness. My cousin and I were supposed to be celebrating like our mates, but Tawfiq and my family are not around, and I'm not capable of continuing my education.
Many Palestinian students in the Gaza Strip who have lost their homes and family members are not able to carry on with their test for the time being due to the state of depression and instability they are in following the war over Gaza. Roba Shavit, Gaza.
In the limelight. London-based Advanced Pharma and its subsidiaries were found to have charged excessive and unfair prices between 2009 and 2017 for leothyronine tablets, primarily used to treat hypothyroidism, which affects at least 2 in every 100 people and can lead to depression, tiredness, and weight gain. We're prepared to an article written by Rob Davis under the heading Drug Firm That Hiked Prices by 6,000% Paid Shareholders £400 Million. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. Pharmaceutical firm that inflated thyroid drug prices by up to 6,000% over a decade paid out more than £400 million to shareholders and directors during the same period. London-based Advanced Pharma and its former private equity owners, HG Capital and Cinven, were fined a combined £100 million by the Competition and Markets Authority, CMA, on Thursday, 29th of July. Advanced Pharma and its subsidiaries were found to have charged excessive and unfair prices between 2009 and 2017 for leothyronine tablets, primarily used to treat hypothyroidism, which affects at least 2 in every 100 people and can lead to depression, tiredness, and weight gain. Patients have told how they were left with no option but to pay private doctors for prescriptions and forced to hunt for cheaper tablets over the internet, buying the medication from online pharmacies and foreign suppliers without knowing whether the tablets being sold were actually genuine. At the same time, Guardian analysis has found the company rewarded investors and directors handsomely via a complex system of dividend payments and intra-company loans involving offshore entities. During the period of the Competition and Markets Authority, CMA, found that drug prices were inflated. Companies' house filings show that dividends were paid to entities controlled either from Luxembourg or from Jersey. The company sells a range of drugs, meaning revenues were likely generated by a variety of products, including but not limited to leothyronine. During the period, the shareholder payouts were channeled through Mercury Pharma Group, part of the Advanced Pharma network of companies and one of the firms fined in the CMA's crackdown. Between 2009 and 2012, Mercury Pharma Group paid £44.4 million in dividends, while under the ultimate ownership of HG Capital via a Luxembourg-based entity called Midas. In 2012, fellow private equity group Cinven bought Mercury from HG Capital and merged it with Amdipharm, which it had purchased that year, combining them under the control of a Jersey-based entity called Amdipharm Mercury. Under the ownership of this new entity, Mercury paid a £12.8 million dividend. Cinven sold Amdi Pharm Mercury to Canadian drugs company Concordia Healthcare in a £2.3 billion deal in 2015, but the Jersey-based structure remained in place. Now under Concordia's control, Mercury paid dividends of £240.3 million in 2016